It's 10 o'clock. You're listening to KHNS, Haines, Skagway, and Clockwan. The following program is a production of KHNS. Its content does not necessarily reflect the views or opinions of the Board of Directors and staff of Lynn Canal Broadcasting Incorporated, the licensee. Good morning, Heather Lindy.
Good morning. Happy New Year, Janine.
2019.
Very exciting. Here we are. 2019, kind of a flat year. Nines. You know, 19 isn't the same as 20 or even 18, but on the other hand, it's the 60th anniversary of the state of Alaska.
Oh, there
and
you go.
I'm going to be 60, so I like that. There's some synchronicity there.
Indeed.
Right? And we're starting off on a good note, I think.
I think we're
the show
note.
Today, the Art Matters show, will feature beer and chocolate and quilts and a little reading in that order, which is kind of perfect as well.
I think it's the best order.
I think it is, too. We'll also be letting everybody know what's happening on First Friday in Haines. But our first guest is Eric Stevens, and Eric is a home brewer, an award-winning home brewer, I might add. But he's going to go ahead and introduce himself.
Yeah, hello, everybody out there. I'm on the radio again. Eric Stevens. I'm wearing a different hat today than usual. Usually I wear the Avalanche hat on the radio. Now I'm wearing the beer hat, the homebrew hat.
You're wearing headphones.
And headphones, as always. So I'm a beer aficionado, maybe you could say. I'm a beer drinker. I like beer, and I brew beer. I'm also more of a kind of a scientist, so I like to think of home brewing kind of as alchemy. It's like,
ooh.
Yeah.
So then, first of all, tell us, how did you get into brewing beer from being a beer aficionado to saying, hey, I think I can make this stuff?
Well, it goes way back to my college days, Heather.
Oh, when you didn't have any money and you needed to make some beer in the dorm room.
That's exactly right. We wanted to save some money because beer is expensive. And my roommate at the time, Mikey, he thought to himself, hey, I can do this, and bought a bunch of homebrew equipment. And he kind of spearheaded the whole effort, and I just kind of followed along and watched what he was doing. And we kind of improvised our way through our first beer, and it tasted all right. It didn't go bad, so that was a success. And then I moved to Haines, and I didn't brew beer for years and years. And I moved and became neighbors with Mark Fontenot. And one day One day he came by my house with a fermenter and a bunch of funnels and hoses and equipment. And he said, hey, do you want all this stuff? Because I've used to brew beer. I just don't do it anymore. And you can have all this equipment if you want it. So he gave me a bunch of stuff. And I thought, hey, this is great. I'm going to start brewing beer again.
So, okay, go back to the equipment. If say I want to learn how to brew beer, what's the basic stuff you have to have?
There's a fair bit of equipment, and you can buy all of it in town. You used to be able to buy it all at the fungi shop. I think you still can. But you've got to have a fermenter. It's basically a 5-gallon, roughly 5 to 8 gallon vessel, usually made of glass. They also have plastic ones. Something that you can clean and sanitize really well, and that has easy access to get large quantities of liquid in and out. And it has to be sealable, to be airtight with an airlock, and the airlock's very important. So you got to have a fermenter. You got to have a big pot, like at least 3 gallons, preferably a 5 or 10 gallon pot.
So like a big graniteware one, like you would boil crab in or jam?
Yeah.
Or
did
you
get I used an aluminum crab cooking pot for a while.
Did your beer taste like crab?
No. But
you probably don't want to mix the
two. I was very, very good about cleaning out that pot, actually, to make sure it didn't taste like fish. That's your boil kettle. And, you know, you need some hoses and tubing to transfer the beer from place to place, and maybe a couple other small items.
Funnels.
Hydrometer is an important one.
But, what's a hydrometer?
So a hydrometer is what you use to measure the density of the beer or the wort. And that's going to help you determine how much sugar is in your beer before it ferments and how much is in there after and how strong it is, how much alcohol content there is.
Hmm.
You technically can brew without one, but you're kind of like going into a blind. You don't really know what's going on.
Right. So the chemistry in this is all of this kind of stuff.
Yeah,
there's a certain art to it as well, right? That, you know, just the taste of it has to be, it's so subjective.
You're right. It's definitely an art and a science. On the science side of things, you have to be very precise and very careful when you're brewing beer. You're measuring everything very carefully. You're weighing out all your quantities. You've got to keep meticulous notes of how much you put in, at what point in the process, what temperatures you're mashing at, and how you transfer things from place to place, and which ingredients you're using. If you don't keep these notes, then the next time you brew, you're not going to have any control over the process. So in that sense, it's very scientific. But, you know, on the other side of things, it's just kind of following your gut and experimenting with new wild ideas. Like for me, it was a Devil's Club IPA. I always wanted to combine the taste of Devil's Club with the hoppiness and the bitterness of an IPA.
And now this is the beer that you won at the Southeast Alaska State Fair for, right? You were best of class.
That's right. The Devil's Club IPA, it won best of division, I think is the term at
the
state fair.
So I'm very proud of ribbon.
That. Yeah, I got a bunch of blue ribbons, and that was very exciting. There wasn't a lot of competition that year, to be fair. But I'm still very proud of that beer. I think it deserved it.
Hey, you know, you're competing against yourself every single time.
Exactly.
It doesn't matter if there isn't anybody else there, right? You do the best you can. So can you walk us through, like, say, making the Devil's Club IPA, just sort of basically? I mean, not like the hours that it takes, but generally each of the steps.
Well, let me know if I go on for too long here, because it is a very long process. But for me, it all starts with harvesting the Devil's Club. So for me, I wait till just before the buds come out in the spring, and I harvest the stalk of the Devil's Club and peel off the inner bark, and that's the part that I use. You want to make sure you never use the berries of Devil's Club. Those are poisonous. Just throwing that out there.
Depends on who you want to serve the beer to.
Yep.
I mean, it can't. Can it kill you?
I think the berries are pretty poisonous.
Or does it just make you pretty sick?
Yeah, never use the berries
for
anything. I should never have said that. I just forget that. I said it was a joke. Yep.
Funny.
So I also harvest spruce tip because that kind of helps to balance out that earthy flavor. Make it a little bit more, zesty.
Mm-hmm.
So once I've got my ingredients, there's planning. Planning and preparation is the first step for any beer. Getting your ingredients together, finding a good recipe, ordering your ingredients. And in my case, I've kind of moved past using other people's recipes. I like to build my own recipe now. And I do that through a website. I'm blanking on the name of the website right now. But if you were to Google homebrew recipe builder, you can find a website that will help you calculate the exact quantities you need and calculate how that's going to affect your beer. So that's how I build my recipes with these large calculators. They're really mm-hmm. helpful. And once you've got all your ingredients ordered and you're ready to go, there's the pre-day preparation where you've got to be sanitizing your equipment, boiling up a couple of gallons of sanitized water. You can use distilled water if you want, but I use tap water and then I boil it off mm-hmm. to make sure it's completely sanitary. So that's a day before step. And you want to have a good procedure to follow. So there's homebrew books that you can follow along with, or there's websites, or you can have a mentor. Someone can kind of teach you the process. But you're going to get a slightly different process from each of these sources.
From each one, right. It's like jam, it's like bread, it's like anything.
It's amazing. You know, everybody thinks they know the exact right way to do it, but everybody does it differently. There's little bitty differences and various steps in the process.
Well, it's probably why beer tastes different. I mean, one person's IPA is different than another person's.
Exactly. And it's just another reason you've got to keep really careful notes and make sure you're going off the same procedure every time and modifying your procedure if you find a step that doesn't work out perfectly. So I've got my own steps that I've listed out. That's a combination of advice from other people and things I've read on the internet and things I've read in books. And I follow that procedure. And so then you're ready for brew day.
Mm-hmm.
On brew day, you're basically boiling up your water. You're adding your grains, and you bring it to a very particular temperature.
And the grains, what kind of grains are you adding in? And do they look like rice or do they look like powder, like flour?
So usually you're using entirely barley. And when they malt barley, it's a process of killing it at a certain temperature that kind of roasts the malts to a very particular level of doneness. And that gives it a particular flavor, but it also creates enzymes that are going to be important because they're used in the mash process to convert the sugars, the starches, into simple sugars that the yeast can digest and turn into alcohol. So it's kind of complex, but you're going to be ordering grains that are already malted, and you're adding those to your mash tun, basically, for the mashing process. And mashing is probably the most important step, I think, in the brewing process. So mashing is basically you're holding the grains.
Here, wait a second. I'm just going to shut the door because you hear the hammering in the hall. They're doing a little work here in the Chilkat Center. So I don't want you to think that it's like fireworks or something. You keep going. Aaron.
Okay, so anyway, you're in the mashing process. You're holding your grains at a very particular temperature. And for me, I mash at 151 degrees Fahrenheit, exactly 151. And you're trying to keep your grains at that temperature for as long as possible, at least 60 minutes, maybe 90 minutes.
At 151, no matter what.
Yeah, so there's a very close range. It's between 146 and 156 Fahrenheit.
Uh-huh.
That's the temperature at which you want to mash. And that's the ideal temperature at which those enzymes in the grains are going to break down those starches into simple sugars.
And this has to stay for 90 minutes?
60 to 90 minutes. It kind of depends on what temperature you're at. Some people mash a little bit higher, maybe 153, 154. And if you do that, you're going to have a more full-bodied beer, mm-hmm. But it's going to be less. You're going to less efficiently convert those sugars or those starches into sugars, so you're going to end up with a lower alcohol content beer, but with more body. It's going to be a little bit heavier on the mouthfeel.
This would just be a disaster for me. I could see this. I mean, just canning fish, you know, watching the pressure cooker,
yep.
And that at least regulates when it goes up and down. But, you know, running around with the dials and trying to keep it that way, and then if it goes too high or too low, do you just have a disaster?
It can, yeah. If your strike water is too hot, and this is why you need calculators to calculate exactly what temperature and how much water you're going to add to your grain bed, because if you accidentally add water that's too hot, then your mash is going to start too hot.
Oh,
and
Eric.
Then you've already converted all your sugars at the wrong temperature, and it can mess up your whole beer.
Okay, so you brew the beer, you've done the mash, then what do you do? You filter it. Let's go fast forward a little because
mashing is called lautering. And lautering is just the process of rinsing the wort from the grain.
And the wort is the stuff you want to drink?
Yeah. Okay. The wort is basically the sugars and the delicious flavors that come from the grains, just rinsing all that off the grains. And there's easier ways to do it. There's harder ways to do it. There's a bunch of different ways to lauter. I use a sparge process where I'm sprinkling water at a very particular temperature. I think I use 170 for the lautering or the sparge water. I sprinkle that very evenly over the grains and then filter it out through my mash tun. There's mm-hmm. a valve at the bottom that it filters through.
Okay, and then you bottle it, right?
Well, so you've lautered off your wort into your
this
kettle.
This is a good thing you do this in the winter to get ready for that. And part of the reason we're actually doing the show like this right now, too, just to remind you, is that, you know, it's January, and it's a good time to be spending a lot of time
picking up
with
new
stuff
hobbies.
Like this. The nights are long, and there's no holiday coming up until Valentine's Day. I mean, I suppose you might have a party on Martin Luther King Day, but it doesn't have the same kind of celebratory you know, nature. It doesn't take you weeks to prepare for that. And anyway, the idea is to get yourself set up so that you can enter something in the fair to practice, do a couple of rounds of this, and come up with like the perfect bottle to enter.
Yeah,
and,
I mean, you want to do it many times because there's so many details to get right.
Mm-hmm.
But it sounds really complex, and it is. But you kind of get it down if you do 5 or 10 batches of beer, and then beyond that, it just gets easier and easier.
And in a batch, how many bottles do you make?
Usually it's 5 gallons of beer per batch.
So what does that transfer to like a case of beer?
Ooh, it's a good question. I use 22-ounce bottles that are bigger.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's probably
a couple
easier.
Dozen
it's like
bottles.
Using pints instead of the little tiny jugs.
Yeah,
you don't have
exactly.
to clean as much and do all that. Right?
Yeah, and it's like a bottle of wine. It's just the right amount for two people.
You invite someone over. And then if it's not that good, you don't have to dump out so
that
many
too.
Bottles.
Sometimes a batch goes bad. You know, if you get an infection in your beer and it goes sour. Sometimes that happens, and I've tried to drink 5 gallons of sour beer before. It's not pleasant.
Now, what about, do you ever have those stories, you know, that I know my grandmother used to talk about this, like the bottles exploding under the kitchen sink, you know, the tops coming off. I think she was talking about like root beer or
that
sarsaparilla or something.
I've never had that happen.
Has that ever happened?
That's just a consequence of having too much bottling sugar. So I'm always afraid of bottles exploding. I'm pretty careful. I don't put that much bottling sugar in. So I've never had that issue, but you want to be careful about that.
Or put them in a cupboard at least, so if they go kabloom, it's not all over the, you know,
that's
open
right.
shelf.
Yep.
Do you have any words of sort of encouragement for someone that is ready to give this a try?
Yeah. So I guess some tips I would give, I would say work with someone who's done it before, someone who's willing to kind of show you the ropes and help you out, because there's so many little particular things that you'd never think of, like when you're trying to siphon beer from a kettle into a fermenter and the hoses are falling everywhere. You need a second set of hands. You got to have someone else to help you out.
Mm-hmm.
And there's all sorts of little tricks.
And it's hot,
to make it
too.
Easier.
You need sort of hot
pads. Oh, yeah.
Pads
yeah.
And stuff.
Usually you're dealing with boiling wort, and you don't want to spill that on yourself. So you want to be careful. But in terms of encouragement, I'd say anybody can do this. It's just a matter of having the equipment and having the time. It takes a lot of time, but it's worth it if you're interested in the process and you're looking for something to take up your time on a long winter day.
You know, and it's something that people have been doing for hundreds of years.
I
mean, and in all different ways and spaces. I mean, you know, there's that book Up in the Old Hotel. Have you read that?
Oh, I've heard great things.
And they talk about all the bars in New York City and how they all brewed their own beer. I mean, every bar back at the turn of the century, whatever, just did it in house, and the
I would
beer
love
on
to
tap
know
was
how
beer
that
that they
beer
were
tasted
making.
Compared
I don't know
to
that.
Today's
yeah.
ales. Or is it similar? Is it? It seems like it would probably be a lot worse back in the day because they probably didn't put a lot of time into it. But I don't know.
Maybe they
did. Maybe it was even better than ours.
I don't know. And now, and isn't it true that I think I've read this that IPA, the history behind that, the India Pale Ale, was so that it would last on long trips, right? That beer holds well without being refrigerated. Isn't that correct?
Yeah. So I think the idea is that the hops act as a preservative.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So I think there was the idea is that if you're trying to, you know, bring your beer for on a 3-month voyage across the ocean, the best way to keep it preserved would be with a lot of hops.
Yeah, and we're really fortunate here in the Upper Lynn Canal to have breweries. We've got two. I know we've got three now, right? Yeah. There's two over in Skagway and one in Haines, and it's pretty exciting. And I think there's something too, isn't there? I mean, not to get too highfalutin, but there's something sort of fundamental about making your own food, your own drinks, and understanding that you can do this without.
I think it's
getting
part
it
of the
from the store.
Part of the subsistence lifestyle for me. I like to, you know, hunt. I like to make my own jerky and my own jam, and you know, gather my own vegetables and grow my own vegetables, and I brew my own beer.
And so you can have a completely local meal.
I do it often.
That's great.
And having your own local beer to add to it is just, it's one of the best feelings when you put so much time and effort into brewing this thing. And like you said, it is like an art form. It's like, you know, you spend hours and hours on a painting, and finally when it's done, you get to look at it and put it on your wall and enjoy it. And for me, drinking that beer at the end is the same feeling.
Yeah, and sharing it with friends, too.
Absolutely.
You know? Great. Well, thanks very much, Eric, for coming in. This has been, it kind of makes me want to think about brewing beer. My husband did it for a little bit. He gave it a try, but then Paul started brewing beer. It was just much easier.
Oh, yeah.
to
if you
get
want
good
a really
beer.
Good beer, just go to the brewery. But if you want to have some fun and make some art, brew your own.
Yeah, yeah. Well, thank you. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Okay.
That's Eric Stevens joining us on Art Matters. And Heather, we'll take a quick break. I have music buds for our breakers from Brad Richter, a classical guitarist who's going to be coming to Haines.
And when is that? It's the 15th, right? January 15th.
January 15th.
And that's Martin Luther King's birthday, isn't it?
Oh, that's how you could celebrate.
I think that's true. I think that's the day.
Yeah, so that's at the Chilcat Center, and we'll hear some guitar work from him. And then we have a guest coming up, Shannon.
We've got chocolate. We've got Shannon McFeeters is going to be here to talk about the art of making her chocolate truffles and more. So stay tuned.
Thank you.
Welcome back to Art Matters. Janine Allen and Heather Lundy here with
you.
This is fun.
It's fun. We're going for the next day. And I explained this a little bit to Eric, too. But the idea behind doing the show right now is because it's January. People get kind of low and looking for things to do that are that are maybe new and time consuming and something that they might not have time for in spring and summertime. Mm-hmm. And then it's things that you could maybe enter in the fair or just have for gifts even this time next year, you know, right. So you're not scrambling in November and December to make your holiday treats or whatever. And also just something that is sort of a comfort, makes mm-hmm. people happy. And we've mm-hmm. gone from beer to chocolate, and then we're going to go to quilts, and then we're going to go to some reading, short little poems and such from Debbie Knight Kennedy is coming in. So, and I also just want to say that Shannon McFeeters is in the studio right now, and Becky Nash is also here, and Becky's kind of listening in, but she may just jump in since she's a chocolatier herself, but she wanted to make sure she knew what was going on with right. this whole show. But anyway, Shannon, welcome.
Thank you.
And Shannon is maybe known by many of you as the coordinator for the volunteer coordinator and all around guardian angel for all of us with Hospice of Haines. Mm-hmm. So thank you for that while you're here. And also for chocolate and chocolate truffles, those round. Mm-hmm. So I guess what I want to know first is, how did you start making chocolate? Is this something like, are you Belgian? Where did this come from?
No, not at all. Okay. Honestly and truly, I just love chocolate. My husband knew that. He was looking for a gift. He bought one of those little boxes, you know, make your own truffles. But these were the hand-rolled kind. And I made them the first time, and I thought, oh, these are delicious. But, ooh, what a mess. You know, who likes to have brown stuff all over them? So I thought this would be fun to kind of investigate and find out. You know, you go to a chocolate shop, and of course you see those beautiful chocolates.
Right, the little ones with the glaze over the top.
Right, and beautiful designs and things, you know, on the top of them. So I thought I'll see what's out there. And there's a whole world of chocolate.
Of course there is.
And who knew? But it's all accessible to us. So I got some molds and start experimenting, and lo and behold.
So molds are then how you make a little chocolate, like in the box that you open up from See's Candy or whatever,
right.
And you've got your little things.
Right. And when you do it at home, it's a little different because here in Alaska, chocolate is not always that easy to get. So everything is, I order everything in. And then I use the molds to paint chocolate in. And I actually use an old-fashioned pastry brush and paint the chocolate in. I make the ganache. And then I experiment with different flavors, depending on what I like.
Let's just go back to terms a little bit.
Okay.
Now, the ganache, what's
yes.
that?
I
hear that
cream.
All the time.
Yeah.
You know, ganache cakes, ganache chocolate. So what's
right.
ganache? What's in it, and what's the definition of it?
I don't know the official definition.
Well, whatever. You know what it is,
cream
though.
And chocolate, right? Mm-hmm. It's what makes the chocolate melt into this creamy form. I use cream and butter and chocolate, which makes it all better, right?
Of course.
Yes. And so then it'll actually thicken up into that creamy
so like when you bite into that little crack shell and you have, that's what is a truffle then.
Right.
Right. Or like, mm-hmm. Why is it, we had an exchange student from Belgium and her family, it was the best thing about having an exchange
yes.
student from Belgium is that they sent us a lot of chocolate. And her family was always sending us chocolate to say thank you. But they were called pralines in Belgium, but they weren't like what I always thought pralines were, pecan stuff from New
right.
Orleans. And they were the same. It was a truffle with the hard chocolate on the outside and the soft center. Do you know why that is, or is it just
a different term?
But it's the
Maybe
same
or what's
thing.
In it, even the filling. Yeah, I think they're
okay.
very similar. And we just call it ganache, maybe because it's easier. But ganache can also be something on top of a cake.
Right.
You know, it's the creamy chocolate. Yes.
So do you have, like Eric was talking about, Eric Stevens, who was here before you, and the whole beer thing, and he was talking about the temperatures and the science of it and the alchemy. This is, I'm guessing that making chocolate's pretty scientific.
Yes, it can be. Maybe not as much that I do. I kind of stay out of the
science. Yeah, but yours, I've had yours in those little cardboard boxes, and they're like the same every time. They never look floppy or
taste. Yes, but it's really easy to ruin chocolate. It is. If it gets water in it, if it, you know, so if you, as you're steaming that coating for the chocolate, you know, the outside that's in the mold, the crispy part, it can get, it can, I don't even know the technical term, but it can harden and be as like cement.
Now, so isn't the wintertime a good time to do it instead of the summer?
Time.
Because, you,
yes.
you know, everything would just be a disaster in summertime. So practicing in the winter is probably good.
Yeah, it's perfect. Because you, but you don't want to start a hot fire. You don't want your room. Nice
so it's supposed
toasty.
To be down in the single digits here this weekend. So this might be a really good time
really
to
good
sit
time.
Around and make chocolate because you're not going outside anyway, and it's going to be really nice and chilly over on the kitchen counter and
Absolutely.
Against the house side of the wall, right?
Yep, and you'll warm up just making those chocolates and.
So can you, now Eric sort of walked us through beer. We couldn't go through the entire process
right.
because that seemed to take a long, long time. But can you walk us through making one, like like making a little batch of these, what
sure.
what you do and how you do it?
Yeah. So the first I decide is what I want to make. What flavoring do I want together?
Is there something for, say, a beginner that is the best one to start with?
Mm-hmm. Probably vanilla, you know, just your best vanilla.
Okay.
Your Mexican vanilla or a really good... vanilla bean, maybe, and you're going to warm up the cream to a little simmer.
Just full heavy cream.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
I don't want to give my butter. You want to add
you don't. You
butter.
Don't have to give your secrets away. Just a general idea.
A pinch of salt because salt makes that chocolate taste better. And then you melt your chocolate in the warm cream. You put your flavorings.
I am like getting hungry.
You put your
flavorings. I can smell it.
Yeah. Your favorite alcohol works really well. Just
beer.
Know, like beer is
really?
Wonderful for truffles. Just a tablespoon or so. Blend it all together. When it's nice and creamy, you cool it until it hardens. And then you're going to take your mold and you're going to melt your...
And the mold is made out of what? Is it like a...
I have both silicone molds and I have plastic molds. Mm-hmm. You want something like an inch, you know, at least an inch, so you have plenty of room to fill.
Okay.
And you don't want to waste any
And
chocolate.
Those are what make you have round ones, and that make it come out round like you do.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just a flat little
Yeah, you
thing.
Can have squares,
okay.
you can have round,
okay.
different shapes. You paint, after you've melted your dipping chocolate, you paint it in there, and then you wait till that hardens, and then you add just, you know, some of your ganache that is just a little bit. It's not rock solid, but it's also not creamy.
It's like peanut butter sort of a texture.
Yeah, like peanut butter texture.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. You put that in there, and then you tap on some more melting chocolate on top. Freeze it for about 30 seconds, just so it, or maybe even 2 minutes, depending on how thick your chocolate is. You want that hard so that when you pull it out, it'll come out of the mold real quick.
Mm. Wow.
But you don't have to be that complicated. You can make
That didn't in. Sound all that hard, except,
no,
of course, if you blow it on any of the steps, it's
so,
you can still eat it, though.
You can still eat it. It still tastes delicious. It increases your dopamine levels, so it's wonderful. Serotonin.
This is good.
All good. Yep. And, you know, the worst case scenario, you just take the ganache, you roll it in between your hands, put it in your coconut. You know, you can put outside layers on it, cocoa dust.
Little ground nuts or something,
yeah,
and just give it to someone and they just think that you're wonderful.
Right.
Okay.
They have no idea what a mess your kitchen looks like.
Now, Shannon, a lot of times and part of the focus of, you know, doing this is even this program is to sort of take a look at like the overarching thing, like why creating things, why making things, you know, makes us feel better, makes the world better. Is there something very satisfying? Obviously, chocolate's so easy. I mean, who doesn't love it when you give it to them? But for you, is there, what's the, what do you get from this?
It brings joy to people. Who doesn't love it? It's like flowers, right? I always thought the best job in the world was to deliver flowers because you get joy on people's face. Well, chocolate does the same kind of thing. And everybody loves, it feels indulgent. It feels special. And to make people feel special is a pretty wonderful thing. And especially in the winter when it's cold and dreary, invite them over for a little truffles and wine or beer
or cocoa.
Coffee or cocoa.
Oh, truffles with some cocoa or even tea, you know, with cream and sugar and truffles.
Anything. Truffles never go wrong.
This is not the program if you're starting like Whole30 today. Maybe you should just, or you could just listen to it and be you know, this is enough for you. This would be your sweets.
That's your sweets, yeah.
Do you have any recommendations of any places to get recipes or books or, you know, because I imagine so much of it depends on the type of chocolate and the ingredients. There must be a lot to that, right?
There is. And my favorite place is I actually got a little letter from Jackie Horn, who loves truffles. And
right, former
visited...
Presbyterian pastor, yeah, co-pastor sort of here, yes.
And she visited a chocolate shop and saw all the great combinations, right? So she sent it to me as inspiration. And these are the flavorings that they had there. Do you want to make any of these? I think that you can go anywhere online and find stuff about how to make truffles. And
do you have a favorite chocolate that you use? Like when you read like Guttard chocolate or
Belgian chocolate?
Belgian chocolate. Is that what you that's your
best.
That's the best you think? I imagine everybody has it sort of like anything, you have your favorites, but you like that.
Right. And dark. The darker, the better for
the
me.
And that's good for you, actually.
Yeah. See?
Oh, okay.
It's not so bad.
All right. Well, thank you very much, Shannon, for coming in. This is quite inspiring.
Yes,
I think I might do better with chocolate than beer. Beer could be a big disaster.
That's true.
Thank you.
You're very welcome.
Thank you. I will take another quick break with some music. And
we'll give you the First Friday stuff, and then we're going to talk to Becky Nash about quilting.
It's hot in here.
It's hot in here. Take your jacket off, Becky. You can't because you're in your pajamas.
Yeah, I know.
You're listening to Art Matters on KHNS with Heather Lindy and Janine Allen, and we just spoke to Shannon McPheeters. So that was great.
On chocolate.
About chocolate.
I'm inspired.
And I started off talking to Eric Stevens about beer.
Yes.
So this is all going very well.
This is well. And we've got Becky Nash in the studio, and Debbie Nye Kennedy is also here to talk about some writing stuff. But first, we do want to go over some of the First Friday events.
Yeah. So First Friday is tomorrow, which is hard to believe. I'm still getting used to the fact
that First Friday of 2019.
Yeah. And there's lots going on in Haines. The theme seems to be soup.
There's comfort and
comfort
joy
soup.
And those kind of things.
Yeah. So,
and everybody's got a lot of leftovers and they're not eating much except for chocolate and soup.
Lots of soup. So, but yeah, a quick overview. The Arts Confluence has a painter, Katie Kirby. She's going to display her oil paintings on wood. It's called Shades of the Desert. So a bit of
warmth.
A bit of warmth.
Or it can
yes.
be cold in the desert, too. I don't know. But
this is true.
Sun goes down. I've heard such a thing, but.
And there's just a lot of businesses and organizations with soup, including La Loft, Alaska Rides, Art on Main Street, Alaska.
So wait, you walk around and you just get soup everywhere?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
little cups, little types of soup. And I know the museum is having soup and an Eldred Rock sort of a thing happening there.
Yeah, they're
serving soup.
They're serving a seafarer's stew.
Okay.
Salmon chowder. And they have an art therapy event from 4 until 7 to draw, color, or paint a lighthouse image.
Well, that's very nice. So you can actually start your new year doing something creative at the museum.
Yeah, and with some nautical-themed soup.
Right, some of the other things, too. I know there's a show of the student artwork at the brewery.
That's correct.
Art teacher Linus Danner has some of her star students, and they'll be showing their work. Will be up in the brewery for, I imagine, a month or so. And, of course, that's always great. I mean, Linus is probably more responsible than anybody for making sure our students all know how to draw and paint and color and have been inspired. And now we're seeing a whole generation of adults that are in the community that have benefited from that. So that should be inspiring. And also I want to let everybody know too that Community Ed has classes. Betsy Van Berg is doing a pottery class. Leisha Schwartz is doing a fitness and wellness event is happening. There's also a drawing class mm-hmm. that is happening. There's Chicks with Sticks. There's knitting. There's a whole bunch of stuff on the Community Ed website if you're looking for something, maybe a group to motivate you a little bit. And the other thing is that registration for Northwoods Writers Conference in Skagway is open, and Susan Orleans is going to be the kind of the head
the main
writer, the featured writer, and that is a great thing. And so that's something you might want to plan for as well. But now let's talk to Becky Nash, who is the quilter extraordinaire, as always. But you can go ahead and introduce yourself any way you'd like, Becky.
Well, I don't consider myself extraordinaire quilter, but I have caused a lot of people to get hooked on quilting, and my husband doesn't understand why we take perfectly good cloth, cut it up, and sew it back together. But, you know, it keeps us out of the bars. So we're happy, and my quilting group has been going on now for, quite a few years, the Rapinski Rippers. And I'll put a little ad in for us. We meet the first Saturday of every month at the Catholic Church, and anyone that would like to learn about quilting or see our show and tell or get in on our activities is welcome from 9 to 4.
That is great. That's exactly what we're looking for.
Okay.
Is someone to find a place to go to learn. And can you like really be like all thumbs and never have quilted anything or even know how to sew?
Do you know, I knew I had a beginner when she pulled a brand new sewing machine out of her box and said, which way do you put it on the table to work it?
That could be a question I might ask.
In a week's time, she had made a small quilt.
Really?
Yeah, I'm not bragging about my teaching, but, you know.
In a group, if you have a whole group of people there.
And we have people that come that have never quilted, and now they're turning out. In fact, I just got a quilt from a woman that just started with our group, and now she wants me to quilt her beautiful top that she's done. So, yeah, it's not that hard. Even you could do it, Heather.
I could. I know my children have done it thanks to you. I might be able to. I love though, Becky, and I don't know if I could do this, and this is where the art of it comes in. It's the putting the fabrics and the colors and the patterns and the textures all together in a design, and how that works, and how you, like, if you were going to start a piece, what's sort of your method of, say you're just making something small, like a table runner or something, what do you do?
Well, first of all, I think, is this going to be for somebody? And then if it is, then I think about what they like or what their colors or whatever. But I never make a career out of it. I just start grabbing cloth, and it talks to me, and it tells me if it likes to play with this one or that one, and I throw some out and I put some in, and I just go with it. My biggest problem is people that say we can't decide what colors to use, because I never have that problem. I don't understand why people can't just jump in and do it. But some people, I guess, are just way more analytical, and they have to have a plan and a recipe, and I just go for it. And some of my things turn out really great, and some things I cut up and make into something else, and it's not a big deal.
Right. It's a work in progress all the time. You always have another one to make.
Unfortunately, I have what the quilters call UFOs. unfinished objects. I have boxes and boxes of them because I kind of have a short attention span. And I also don't have a lot of time to do what I really want to do. You know, if God made me creative, why do I have to do dishes and clean toilets? You know, it's a pain in the butt to have to live aside from your art. And that's a constant problem in my family because I'm kind of a hoarder. Not really a hoarder. I just collect wonderful things.
Well, fabrics especially.
Oh, fabric. In fact, the other day I was going through some boxes that have been packed in my shop for several years, and I found an amazing array of beautiful cloth that I didn't even know I had.
So I have
a
question for you.
It was so exciting and inspiring.
So when you're also a judge for the fair.
Yeah.
And when you're judging a piece, like someone, and the quilts in there, I mean, every year, maybe it's just me and I'm noticing them more, but it seems like they're getting better and better and better and more. I mean, they're just so good, it kind of takes your breath away sometimes. What do you look for when you're judging a quilt?
Okay. One of the first times I ever was a judge for the fair was I still lived in Pelican and they brought me. You know, the fair used to have funds to bring people that were somewhat knowledgeable in the field, like Remineau came to do the paintings and different people. Now it's pretty much any warm body they can grab because people are busy.
Well, you're here though, so you're the
quilt expert. So it's kind of you. For one thing, you have to put aside your own preferences and biases. Like, I may hate a certain color, and then here's a quilt that's in those colors. Well, I can't judge it based on that I don't like that color. So the first thing I study is the workmanship. And you have to take into consideration, is this somebody that's been doing it forever? Or is it a little kid? And you kind of look at it. And I like to give tips to improve their quilting, but you have to be careful because a lot of adults are very sensitive about comments from the judge. And I just want people to know that it's so exciting to have you do something and turn it into the fair. And our exhibits overall have gone way, way down over the years. And I know it's for a couple of reasons. Number one, we're not doing these things out of necessity. We have the distractions of Wi-Fi and iPads and all that. And it's expensive to get into quilting or knitting or whatever if you want top dollar. And it takes a lot of time. But I would encourage people in the winter to put aside your Wi-Fi and be intentional about something you'd like to make because for one, Harriet Hall is my number one priority when I go to the fair. Mm-hmm. I want to see other people's workmanship. I want to see what they've done.
I love how they've done it. I just love going in and seeing the
talent. And it
would
be very disappointing if that hall was empty, which it seems like it's getting there too quickly.
So, but this is a great time then. I find, and I don't know if you do too, and I've got Debbie here, so I might bring her into the conversation because Debbie's going to be talking about writing as well. But you, both of you spend a lot of time in the winter months on just creative projects. And I think that's still the thing that we've got in the North that's different than other places. And I mean, you know, you can only spend so much time, I think, on your computer or device or whatever, and you start to like lose it. I know just for me, I ended up buying a manual typewriter recently because I found that working as a writer on the computer, you know, ping, here comes the email, and ping, here comes the news alert, and you know, God knows what's just happened again, and it would just send me off the rails. And so I ended up just getting a manual typewriter to sit and work on sometimes because it felt more fun, like I was making something. And in the summer, I probably have no time for sitting around with my typewriter, be outside or in the garden. There's a million other things.
Yeah.
But, you know, on a winter night when the sun is down at 3 o'clock, it's kind of fun to play with the typewriter till 4:30 or 5.
Yeah.
And anyway, but Debbie, how do you feel about all this creativity stuff?
I would call myself a maker of things. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't matter what, as long as I'm making things, it's good. And when I'm making things, whether they're poems or little blank journals that I've been making or carving or whatever, I have no idea when the sun goes down. It doesn't make any difference at all. So I noticed when I first moved here, it wasn't light deprivation that got me. It was color, because I used to work in ivory. And so I had color deprivation because, you know, it's all the same. So once I started working in other mediums, that went away. And now really, winter's great.
Mm-hmm. And do you find that the winter time is your big creative time, or is it all the time?
Kind of. It's when I have the most time, but I never stop. Even when I had like my little gallery, when people weren't in it, which was a lot, I started writing poetry.
Now that is kind of why I asked you to come in here today, because I was thinking about the wintertime, and I've just started experimenting with very simple poems, you know, haikus and acrostics, you know,
forms,
where you use the first letter of the word to say something. And it's like, I can do that. And you could have children do that. And it's fun. And I wondered if you had any, because you're so prolific and you're always seem to me fearlessly writing things and making
things.
Little things. Do you have any thoughts about encouraging people to do that, and what's a good way to do it? And I know you also go to classes sometimes or take online classes.
I do. I take some online classes that are really fun. They're not very formal, which I love. I have actually, okay, here's my one book suggestion. I have a couple, but there's a book, Ariel Gore. She's a woman that I take some classes with online.
Mm-hmm. Ariel, A-R-I-E-L-G-O-R-E.
Yeah,
right.
Yes.
Okay.
And her book, How to Become a Famous Writer Before You're Dead,
was... Good luck with that.
Oh, no, well, it's tongue-in-cheek.
I know.
It's very fun. But it got me started on so many things of just plunging in, including making my first zine a bunch of years ago.
And zine is a short magazine, right? Or it's just
it's a self-published thing that you do for the love of it, not for the making money.
Mm-hmm.
Bad way to make money.
Yeah.
Good way to spend time.
Mm-hmm.
So I would encourage that book. It's fabulous.
Ariel Gore. Say it again.
Ariel Gore, How to Become a Famous Writer Before You're Dead. It's awesome.
Do they have it at the library?
I don't know.
We'll have to find out.
Well, okay. They should.
Yes.
Making things. So it's short writing pieces. Writing little essays, writing little poems, writing anything. You can put those into a zine. It's the most fun thing. And it
letters, too, I found.
And that's
the thing with the typewriter, too. My handwriting's so bad.
Letters.
And I always think, well, writing on the computer's kind of impersonal. Our email isn't quite the same. But I did, you know, for my dad, I just typed him a letter for Christmas. And my aunt, who's 90, you know, and It's kind of interesting because it's all of a sudden you're sort of formal, like you're back. I was almost like back in fourth grade, like thinking, do I have to put the address up on the right side and line up the margins? And where do you say yours? You know, remember learning those forms for letter writing that nobody cares about anymore? So then I was like, oh, heck with it. Just type.
I wrote a whole zine of letters. I wrote letters to Barbie, the doll.
Right.
And made that into a zine, threw in some collage, and it became a little booklet thing.
Do you have a recommendation of how much time a day to spend on it? Say, if you want to begin journaling or writing.
You know, it's
poems.
Funny. I always hear professional writers say how much time they spend each day. And me, it's completely random. Sometimes I spend all day. And sometimes I don't write for days. Not because I don't want to. I just, life.
Does this happen?
Dishes.
Becky's nodding her head. Does this happen like with quilting, too?
They get in the way.
You have these big bursts of creativity.
Well, especially if there's a deadline looming that I'm getting a project done for somebody else, but I have so many hats and a couple of little grandkids that I
and
enjoy
Debbie's nodding her head
big
too.
Time with that. Yeah, when you get to be a grandmother, you thought, oh wow, we're gonna get to a certain age and we're gonna have all this time to do everything we want, and then the grandkids show up and it changes people drastically. It's about like having a baby yourself. But I wanna say that you can learn just about anything you want to do online. You Google anything,
you can find tutorials
and you can learn anything you want by yourself watching those. But I have to say that even if it's just once a month or once every while that you get together with like-minded people doing the same thing, it's more than the art itself. You become comrades, you become friends in the
part of
difficulties
a group.
Of life. You support each other, you laugh together, you cry together. And like our little Rippers group has been going for I don't know how many years, I've lost track. But we're really tight because of that, you know? Mm-hmm. And we feel like it's more than just the quilting.
Well, maybe we need to start a little writer's group.
There you go.
Meet at the library or something. I could maybe like that. It is a sort of writing. And
it could be anything.
Knitting, quilting could whatever. Be too. Doing a craft at home. Sometimes it's a lonely exercise mm-hmm. because you tend to be sort of in your own head a lot. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when you find yourself going to the grocery store to visit people, you think to yourself, I should.
A two-people writing group I've done for, because that's as many people as we could get organized,
uh-huh.
for the last couple of years in the summers. And I did find that when you knew the next week you were going to meet with that person, you wanted to have something
to read to them.
Mm-hmm. So that does work. But writing, of course, is solitary.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But you do get feedback.
Absolutely.
If somebody's stuck with a quilt and they say, we just don't know what to do next. And everybody looks at it and they toss out ideas and then it comes together for you. So you have more minds giving you input and feedback, and it's good.
You know, the other thing I found with group things, like when, you know, going to school and you're in workshops with writers, is that it also teaches you to be kind to people. And it teaches you how to speak in public about something that you might be critical of in a way that helps the person rather than just sort of shows off how smart you are or mm-hmm. that you can say something flippant. And that's helped me on the Borough Assembly a lot, you know, because it's always say the positive thing first, mm-hmm. never the negative. Because if you say a negative thing first, whether it's any kind of art, that's the only thing the person remembers, and mm-hmm. or I even remember. You don't remember all the good comments to follow. So they teach you that in critiquing art or writing, to talk about all the good part first, and then at the end you can say, well, and if you want, you know, mm-hmm. this didn't really mm-hmm. work for me, or that didn't, but they've heard all the good stuff, so they're riding high, and it's like, oh, they loved it. There was just mm-hmm. a few things, where if you start with those few things, it goes south.
Well, I call it the ooh and ah, but it's really show and tell. But everybody is so encouraging when you bring a project. It doesn't have to be any little thing or big thing, but everybody has something good to tell you, and it does. It makes you feel good. It makes you feel like you want to do more.
Right. Now, let's, before we're kind of getting down to the end of the show, and I thought, since this is kind of chummy here and we're at New Year's, just sort of, does anybody, if you want to, I don't want to put you on the spot, and I'll include Janine in this too, does anybody have any sort of art kind of or creative related sort of New Year's, I won't call them resolutions, but kind of goals for the next year? Is there something that you're kind of working on that you want to share or encourage or just say out loud, or no?
I have of course a million projects, but I have one book that's almost done that's been about 4 years in the making. So that's going to be done. And I'm thinking I can do a April 1st Friday maybe at the bookstore with this book, because it's National Poetry Month, and it's a book of poems.
And read them. Do a reading.
And do a reading.
Do the whole thing, like a poetry reading?
Like that.
I'd love that.
And I don't know. Well, that's one goal. And then I intend to, while that book's kind of just getting printed, I mean, I'm doing self-published the way I do.
Mm-hmm.
And while that's happening, I'm going to start a new project that is much lighter, that's going to be kind of a fictional version of, not really me, little bits of me going in there, of a young woman coming to Alaska who's kind of naive, not just a little naive, because she's never been here. So it's going to be a little...
And we're still naive and we live here.
Right.
I think all of us were there once.
Everything,
and some of us still are.
Yeah. Well, like I said, there's bits of me in there, but it's not me. So that, I'm going to lighten up, because the poetry book was kind of intense. And that's going to be my writing project for the year. So.
Becky, you've got anything that you're thinking of?
Well, I have several things in the works that I'd like to complete, and a couple that I've promised that I'd like to get going on. So I always have a long list.
I bet you do. And Janine, do you have anything?
Yeah, I have. There's a new podcast from our U.S. Poet Laureate, Tracy K. Smith. I love her.
Uh-huh.
It's called The Slowdown. It's 5 minutes every morning, and I want to listen to it every morning. I've been doing it. It's so lovely. I love her voice.
What does she do? Does she do a poem?
She reads a poem, but she frames it with context from her own life, and I just feel time slow down.
I got to write this down, The Slowdown.
The Slowdown.
And it's just 5 minutes.
5 minutes a day. I've been listening to it first thing in the morning when I wake up, and it just sets the nicest, most thoughtful space for me. The Slowdown, Tracy K. Smith. Really, really recommend.
Wow. Well, I'm deciding that I'm going to try to... I got a bunch of projects for this year. Another book is in the works, and it'll be coming out in the what is it, the spring of 2020. But that means 2019 is the kind of production year. And so that'll be busy and kind of busy work, but not necessarily as creative. And I'm thinking of maybe starting a podcast on Find the Good and do it with interviews and with things. And we'll see if that actually gets off the ground. It'd be nice if that might happen by the end of 2019. And what's the other thing? Oh, I'm going to blog more. I've been a little bit thin on the blog, and I think a lot of that had to do with being on the assembly and sort of my mojo being knocked down a little. And I'm feeling better now. And the one thing I was thinking about, I read an advanced reader copy of a book. I don't remember the title of it, but it's a guy in his 40s who did a journal for a year of delights, looking at everything with delight and writing down the things each day that he saw that delighted him. Obviously, the book it's not going to be my book because it's already been written, but it's a neat practice. And I'm thinking about just trying to maybe incorporate that in the blog without hitting anybody over the head. But now that I've told you about it, maybe you can look for it. Anyway, that's my sort of goal. And now I was going to not drink beery chocolate, but now I might change my mind.
I was wondering what kind of seed you're going to cast. You said podcast?
Yeah, podcast. It's like, you know, you do a little radio thing that they can listen to. And you got to start listening to them when you're quilting sometimes.
I'm sure there are quilting podcasts out there.
All right. Okay. Well, thank you, everybody, for coming in today. This is great. And do we have time to run down First Friday, or are we past our time?
Real quick.
Okay. Yeah, you can hop out the door if you want to while we're doing this. So First Friday, again, in Haines, it's a soup and comfort event. There's stuff happening all over town, I guess, in different things. There's Shades of the Desert at the Arts Confluence. There's Hemp Works and a CBD tasting party at Alaska Rods. The Magpie has Cheers to the New Year and new work and gift ideas. The Haines Visitor Center and the Bank has three groups, three soups, Chamber of Commerce, Bank, and Visitor Center. And the museum also has soups and an art project. The brewery has student art. And, lemony lentil soup is going to be at the Magpie. So that's something to think about.
So
and then the
tomorrow.
Pioneer Bar and Mountain Market and the Mysterious Emporium, the Chilkat Gwan Heritage Center, Haines Home Building Supply, and the Aspen Hostel will also have soup to sample.
Oh, wow.
So there's soup all over town on...
tomorrow.
Yeah.
Tomorrow
and the other thing, we wanted to mention that Wrestling for Jerusalem, Aaron Davidman's film will be shown again in Haines on January
13th? Sunday, January 13th, 7 p.m. at the Chilkat Center.
And the Arts Council has the guitar player on the 15th. And we better get out of here.
Indeed. Thank you very much, Heather.
Thank you, Janine. Happy January.
Happy January. And one final note, that Art Matters is brought to you by the Alaska Arts Confluence, aiming to inspire culture of collaboration by supporting artists and arts for residents and visitors of the Chilkat Valley on Main Street in Haines and online at alaskaartsconfluence.org. You're listening to KHNS, Haines, Skagway, and Klekwan. We will be joining the World Cafe in just one moment.